This is FinTech Chatter, presented by Tier 1 People, leaders in FinTech executive search. And I'm your host, Dexter Cousins. Welcome to the first of our masterclass series. Every month, I bring together experts from the Tier 1 People Network to discuss a particular area of scaling your business. This episode, I'm joined by two special guests and peers from the world of talent and people, Emma Jones of Project F and Sophie Thien of Oakham Group. The foundation of any successful business is people, and we're going to share some strategies on how to hire the right people and keep them happy, motivated, and fulfilled. Emma, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to have you. We've been talking about doing this for a long time.
We have. It's been ages, actually. Finally, here we are.
So would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about Emma Jones?
So I am the CEO and founder of Project F, which has been going for just over 2 years now. I've got a background in people and culture and talent acquisition, exec search, et cetera, for the last probably 26 years, mostly in the technology environment. I've been living in Australia for about 10 years. Before that, I was UK-based, as you can probably tell. but I've been living in Sydney now for 10 years, and very happily so. And I started this company with an absolute drive to change the face of technology. And that is really referring mostly to the state of gender diversity in technology. So I want it to look and feel different in the not too distant future to how it feels today, with a lot more women in it. And, you know, you doing this podcast on fintech is very close to my heart. I've worked in the fintech space, and it has probably more of an issue around gender diversity than many other sectors within tech as well. So I think it's a good one to be talking about today.
Sophie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about Sophie Thien?
Yeah, of course. So in a nutshell, I've been a HR talent advisor for a number of startups in Europe, especially in the UK. I'm also currently the chief people officer at Oakham, where we're a micro lender, but we're actually working towards making credit a lot more accessible to people by using better scorecards. In a lot of ways, I've been in fintech since about 2015, and usually I am the first HR person. So today's topic is one that I'm really keen on discussing with you and Emma.
Awesome. Now, just to give our listeners some context, some of the businesses that you've worked for, they'll know well. Revolut, you were the first HR person there. 11FS, who our listeners will know as well. So you got a lot of experience of dealing with those, you know, businesses and really kind of helping them get from that one to kind of 100, 150. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. When I left Revolut, we were close to over 500, actually. Wow. So, yeah.
So that would have been, what, about 3 months you were there? The rate of pace.
At that point, definitely. At that point, it kind of feel like, you know, 9 months being there, it kind of feel like 3 years. And it was probably one of the most interesting experience I've had. And it was only then that I finally understood what the definition of hypergrowth really means. It just means, you know, we've been scaling so much. My team was from one person into 11 in like 6 months. It was definitely interesting.
Emma, I wanted to do this masterclass episode on hiring and people. And whilst I'd love in an ideal world for us not to talk about the diversity issue, the reality is it's a huge issue, as you've just mentioned, particularly in fintech, where we've got the kind of remnants of banking and financial services, which is a heavily male dominated, certainly at an exec level. And then you've got the tech world coming together, which again is a male dominated environment. But could you maybe share with us just, I guess, some of the facts and the figures around gender diversity in the space and just how much of a challenge it is to...
Sure, of course. I think it's probably not too dissimilar around the world. There's about, I think, 25% of the workforce identify as women in terms of technology. 28% of Australia's fintech workforce apparently is women, according to the research. And I think, you know, that probably the most powerful stat I can give you, well, there's two actually. One is that 56% of women in tech leave tech mid-career. That's more than double the quit rate of men. And I have to follow that up very quickly with the fact that that's not leaving to have children. So 56% of women leave tech mid-career. When you think that through and let it sink in, it's quite a powerful number. Like I say, it's more than double the number of men that quit tech as well. So there are some really clear indicators there that there is a cultural issue. So that is the stat that Project F is trying to have an effect on. So the other stat, the second one that I think is really powerful, is the fact that the pay gap in technology is 7% higher than the pay gap, the national average pay gap. And that's the same in, so from Australia, also in the UK and also in the US. So that's another, I think, quite strong impact about culture and how it's affecting this particular sector.
Why do you think we're seeing such discrepancies?
Three key reasons why women leave tech mid-career. And they're well documented, so the data is out there. This isn't observational. This is real. This is coming from real quantitative data. So the top three reasons are lack of support from management, lack of ability to progress career, so they get stuck. And the third one is culture, and that includes sexual harassment. But the poor culture that is prevalent in this sector, it definitely drives women out. It's not inclusive for women. Women don't feel like they belong in technology. And when you go to most tech environments, even in the nicest, most beautiful companies, you go to the tech part, the dev or engineering teams, and you'll see or experience this change in culture. It's very much created and built around the stereotype, the very out-of-date, antiquated stereotype of the male programmer that doesn't or shouldn't certainly exist anymore. And that is not a place that's comfortable for women. When you start having environments that are, you know, quite ubiquitous in terms of things like, you know, PlayStations and beanbags and scooters and ping pong tables and arcade games and, you know, hoops at lunchtime, you know, craft beer on tap or whatever, you know, all that stuff is very clearly skewed towards one demographic, and it's very exclusionary. So those are the top three reasons. And I just want to move on to the pay gap as well, that as you asked about that, why that is. And again, there's a lot of evidence as to why that is. And I know you and I have been engaged in some discussion on LinkedIn about this recently. There are very clear reasons why this happens in software engineering in particular. And this happens, the data I'm referring to comes mostly from the US, but Silicon Valley, also New York, and other parts of the US where the technology sector is quite prominent. And it comes from the expectation gap. So the evidence and the data shows us, and the research shows us, that when men and women leave university, so at that graduate level, women's expectations of salary are very slightly higher than men's. But that very quickly changes. So once they get out into the world of work, that kind of swaps over. And then they go off in a different direction almost ever after. So men's expectations year on year grow by roughly about $12,000, and women's by about $8,000. Now, over time, that creates a very large gap, and that's in terms of expectations. So what we continue to do is we continue to ask for salary expectations when we hire people. And that comes from a place of not having clarity internally in organizations about what their salary ranges or pay philosophy to start with. You know, how do we want to pay people? How do we want to reward them? Do we want to be at market? Do we want to be slightly above, slightly below? You know, how do we want people to be rewarded for the work they're doing in our company? Now, if we can take the time to change that and bring clarity to it, then we can communicate salaries to prospective employees rather than the other way around. Because what unfortunately happens is that when you've got men and women asking, so that they might be, you know, have the same background, same skill set, same experience set, but their expectations are quite far apart. Most of us will automatically be anchored to the number that we're given when we ask for that expectation. You can see how it happens. And this is an enormous driver. We have this kind of real bias towards secrecy around pay. I think companies think that pay transparency means that everyone's going to know what they're paid and what all the people who work for them are paid. Well, it's not the case. It's more about making sure that you're really clear on what constitutes a mid-level engineer in our company. You know, and how clear is that? Are we going on gut feeling about these people, or are we going on real data as to what they can do, what their impact is going to be in our organization at this level? So what does a mid-level developer look like versus a senior versus a lead or a junior? So once you've got that clarity about what their skill and level is, you can then put a pay range to it. And once you've got a pay range to it, it's very easy then to communicate that externally without revealing what everybody's being paid. It just becomes very clear, and it takes away the ambiguity and the propensity for creating pay gaps.
I agree with you. I think that, you know, this needs to be something that every business gets absolutely crystal clear from day one. Day one, like, this is the strategy. Before we go out and hire anybody, let's get absolutely clear about this.
Yeah, it will make a big difference to your organization from the beginning. Because when you start trying to do this later, it can be quite difficult to wind it back.
Yeah.
So if you've already got a whole, you know, if you start as a founder of a company and you're just starting to grow your team, and your first hires are all about speed to market, you know, let's get this thing built as quickly as possible, just grab some talent, get them working on it and get going. And you kind of don't necessarily automatically stop to think about this. But if you do, what you will avoid is getting to the point where you've got people who have come in as a senior because you just wanted to get them, and actually they're a mid. And then later on, how do you change that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So you're trying to then hire more people into the team, and you're going to come across all kinds of problems then with trying to level people out, put them into the right levels. And I've seen it happen, you know, in numerous organizations, and it's quite painful as a process to go through. But trust me, you will have to go through it at some point, or you will continue to experience problems.
I think that's a really, you know, such a prevalent point that you raise there, Emma. And they've way overpaid for somebody who hasn't delivered. And then they've been burned, and they didn't have that framework in place to protect them, to say, hey, this person actually isn't worth the money, and, you know, compared to other people that we're seeing. So from a business perspective, it makes sense for us not to go with that person.
And when companies do it well, you see examples of how well they've done it and how much of a difference it makes to their hiring capability. So when you start, if you're an early stage founder, and you, one of the first things you do is research your target marketing, it will help you enormously as you start to grow your team. And the other thing is, you know, you mentioned, Dexter, about the, you know, the reasons why people are attracted to companies, or, you know, how am I going to, if I'm starting, how do I afford these people and get them to want to come and work here if I can't pay as well as some of the big guys, right? So that's all about what we call your EVP, so your employer value proposition. If you take an extreme example of, say, a bank versus a charity, those two organizations are vastly different and have a very different employer value proposition. So what is it about a charity that makes somebody want to come and work there? And you think about all the great things about, you know, the people that work in those environments probably don't get paid anything like market rates, but they do it because of something that is important to them, their personal values and what they're getting out of that work. So the reward for them is in a whole bunch of other things that, you know, they will sacrifice that salary for. So if you take that example and then think of this, you know, two different developers going, looking at two different opportunities, one is at a bank and one's at a charity. Those drivers have to be understood by the employers so that they can appeal to what those drivers are and build that into their pay philosophy.
So Sophie, what's been your experience of setting the right salary frameworks from day one to really kind of tackle the diversity issue?
Yeah, I think given that my experience has been the first HR person, setting the right salary benchmarking was obviously extremely important. But I think Emma's point around it being one of the most important things to drive equality is actually really, really true, because in a lot of businesses you see them, you know, you see them reach a certain growth stage and they kind of realize that this becomes a huge challenge just because they hadn't really set up the right foundations yet. So as you go into a startup and using the right kind of salary framework really helps equality, because you also create that kind of mindset and really best practice for leadership to understand that every person can do this role regardless their background, regardless where they come from, for as long as they are able to not just perform the role, but also outperform it itself. And so in a lot of ways, if we're just looking at the job itself, why wouldn't we pay equally? So that's definitely one of the really important things that I try to put in place as I go into new businesses, but also one of those things that I really try and champion as much as I can.
Do you see that it kind of also has an effect on the hiring process as well? And so what I mean by that is that, you know, I've seen it oftentimes where, you know, we're really transparent about salary and we, you know, some of our clients can't pay as well as others. And so we're very clear about, you know, the range that they're prepared to kind of work within. And so for some people, that doesn't work. Emma pointed out earlier around the kind of, you know, some people want to work at a bank, others want to work at a charity that's based around values. Do you think that those people who are prepared to work and work within those constraints because they want to be part of a business that actually has that approach to fairness and paying their staff fairly helps in the recruitment process as well?
I think definitely yes. I obviously couldn't speak about it globally, but in the UK, this is definitely starting to pick up. A lot more startups are now more successful in actually achieving diversity and equality simply based on the fact that one, leadership or the brand itself is starting to able to show that they not just promote equality, but they actually understand it properly. And that's why more and more startups are now talking about, even debating about the issue of salary transparency. Now, obviously, there's a lot of ways that you can do it wrongly, which means you create salary transparency in a business, but then you don't follow the best practice, which essentially just means it's contradicting the framework itself. But when done right, it definitely emphasizes on good hiring processes and good hiring practices. Just like what I was saying earlier, the role should be paid based on a market rate or at least a fair rate that the company believes that they can afford. Now, on the other hand, we're also starting to see a lot more, say, social enterprises, right? And these are the kind of startups that are really mission-driven. And so if they don't have as much funding as I mean, both you and I, Dex, we can tell that fintech usually have a lot more funding than the other industries do. But that doesn't mean that they can't achieve, because they are more purpose-driven. They are mission-driven companies. And so at the end of the day, it will still portray the company as just as competitive as the others.
Emma, that's obviously since COVID, you know, remote work has come into play, and you know, you would have thought that would have made it, you know, more, I guess, you know, easier to hire females, rather than more difficult. And yet what seems to have happened is that businesses aren't taking advantage of remote working, or if they are, they're tending to overload, or females are being overloaded with the home life and business life, making it almost like an untenable position. So I think there's kind of still a long way to go to get the remote working model right. But how can founders use this to their advantage to build diverse teams?
I think for the most part, tech is quite good at this, as in most of them seem to have allowed a change, you know, a real shift, and accelerated that move to remote possible, as a not remote first, of which I think there are quite a lot of companies who have taken this up, but not enough probably, but as a remote option. So there's a blended hybrid model.
I love that term, by the way, remote possible. I think that pretty much sums up where we're at right now.
Well, some of them are sort of going, you know, it's like kicking and screaming, really. They don't really want to do it. But I think the biggest barrier here is the bias, this unconscious bias towards presenteeism. And if work can be done to remove that in a structural sense, then there can be some real benefits to having that access to remote potential. But I still feel that, and I've always, you know, held this view that the biggest driver of equality at work is going to be equality at home. And companies have an opportunity now, I think, to really push that agenda forward, to take advantage of the situation with remote working, where men have got far more involved in the caring responsibilities at home. Yeah. And it's become more normalized that you know, people working from home will have children around, or caring responsibilities to tend to during their day. And men actually want it. That's the other thing that has come out of all of this, I think, is this message from the fathers in the family that actually they really want to be involved. They are quite happy having that sort of blended, you know, working day now, or working week. And so there's an opportunity to really hit that home by introducing better parental leave. When I say better, I mean more equal parental leave offerings. And most companies, I feel that there is a real hesitance based on a fear factor of the cost, when the reality, if they were to do the you know, the commercial modeling, is actually not as scary as they think it would be. But the problem with fintech, of course, is that the majority of leaders are men. So you have an entire industry sector of fintech that's driven by people that understand the gaps in the financial market. And that understanding often comes from experience at a very senior level in finance. And so those positions are still mostly taken by men. So when it comes to making those decisions, there has to be support from I think, human resources, people and culture as a strategic function to give them the sight of the potential of being more progressive around something like this.
Yeah.
It can create a real, you know, differentiator.
Absolutely. And Sophie, I guess, look, we've been really blessed here in Australia. People have pretty much been back to work and going back to the office since July 2020, albeit not full time. But what have you seen in the UK where it has been an enforced lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I think remote working, just going back to the fact that London has pretty much been in lockdown for a whole year itself. And we're slowly now starting to face back into the offices. But a lot of smaller companies especially would have probably already lost their offices, because obviously this is like a heavy cost for them to carry if people are not going back to work that way. But in terms of remote working, I think in London, because the situation or the lockdown situation has been going on for over a year now, a lot of businesses are starting to understand that there's actually a lot of benefits from moving their employees or moving their workforce into either a hybrid model, where, again, you know, it's not remote possible, but it's a half remote and half work, which is great, as well as more and more companies that out of the blue just decided to go remote and it actually works for them. We're one of those. I remember when I joined Oakham, in 2 months' time, the pandemic hit, lockdown started, and we basically, in less than 2 weeks, we've decided that the best thing for our company to do was to go remote even before the other companies did it yet. And so in a lot of ways, we've had a lot of opportunities to test and trials, different kind of ways of working that worked for us. But going back to your point, remote working has been a great, I would say, a positive impact in terms of how fintech has worked, because we are now starting to see more and more conversations and discussions being open around how do we keep the morale high for remote workers that are probably not as engaged because they obviously don't see their colleagues face to face. They don't have that social element. And so the conversations, especially in the HR world, has started to direct itself towards talking about intrinsic motivators. We're talking about more benefits, just like what Emma was saying. We're now talking about equal parental leave, because now this becomes easier to have that kind of discussion, because both men and women, or all parents, are now being working from home, and then even having the opportunity to talk about childcare opportunities. Back in the days, being 1 year ago, you hardly hear any startup talk about this because it's all about cost.
One of the kind of, I guess, concerns that I hear time and again, particularly from founders and leaders with remote working and fully remote working, is that you miss those current kind of serendipitous moments of having a team together. What do you think founders and leaders need to be focused on in order, particularly when they're hiring new hires and they're not going to have them as part of that process?
Who are you asking?
Emma, do you want to tackle that one? Sorry. Yeah. I'm so used to just speaking with one person.
Sophie's probably better equipped to answer this more fully than I am, because she's okay. Actually a human resources professional. But for my part, the one thing I would say is that diversity, that one of the biggest benefits of diverse teams is that ability to share perspective. And using that collaboration and difference, all the differences to solve problems. Now, when you've got people who are based remotely, that feels to me like it would be compromised, that ability to share those diverse perspectives and to collaborate using their differences to problem solve. So if everybody's working in different locations, facilitating that ability to collaborate and to solve problems together would, to me, be one of the highest priorities that of a problem to solve for founders. And the second thing, or my observation, I suppose, on this would be, what we don't traditionally do in technology is equip our leaders well enough to be able to lead and manage people. So very frequently we see a lot of the leaders, people leaders, whether they're technology leads who are responsible for maybe, three or four people in a team, or whether they're engineering managers or heads of and further up. Traditionally, those people will move into those roles in engineering technology areas and, quite heavy tech, through their merit of what they've delivered from a technology perspective. And that's continued in terms of how we measure their success as well and their performance. So when it comes to managing people on teams and their performance, they don't have those tools, and we're not giving them tools to do that other than the basic 101 of people management and people leadership, which doesn't take into account diversity. It doesn't take into account different people and their differences and their different working styles, but differences in terms of, whether it's, differences neurologically or, we're talking LGBT or gender or ability. We don't take those things into account. And that is, I think, exacerbated when you have people who are, or teams that are working in a distributed way. It becomes an extra challenge on top of that. So I think leaders are probably feeling quite frequently a bit overwhelmed with the ability to, you know, to harness these teams in the way that they need to deliver in the way that they're expected to.
Sophie, one of the big challenges that, you know, certainly I've faced doing executive search has been running recruitment processes remotely. And, you know, people coming on board to a business having never physically met anybody in the business, having never physically been around the offices and got a feel for the culture and the vibe of the place. Mm. How do you get that across? You know, when you used to be able to go to an office and you just get that vibe and, hey, you know, these are my kind of people. How do you get that across into an interview process that's done over Zoom and videos?
I think there is that's a really, really good point and observation. But I think I'll point out two things here. One is we definitely shouldn't. I do this as well. We definitely shouldn't refer to like fintech people by just being with their own kind. I think that really that obviously affects the way we look at diversity. Yeah. Right. That's obviously the contrary of what we're trying to achieve here. But you are right. In terms of all the industries that I've been in, fintech is definitely one of those that are very, very close-knitted because it's obviously a new industry. The word fintech didn't even exist before. And I think because of that, the more and more we are finding ourselves really missing the understanding of true belonging. Now, belonging is essentially creating an environment where everybody from different kind of backgrounds can come and play, and they are all fully mutually respected. They know their space. They know what they're achieving, as well as being fully respected as the individual that they are, regardless of the background that they come from. And I think having to go remote, I have now seen a lot more leadership are having these kind of discussions, and it's the right kind of discussions. We're not talking about hiring more women in tech anymore. Well, that has proven itself to be continuous a challenge, but we're now talking about creating that inclusivity within tech so that people can come and join tech, even coming from different kind of backgrounds. Now, following up from Emma's point earlier around leadership in tech normally comes from a technological background where they get promoted into leadership roles because of their merit and credibility, very, very rarely because of their leadership skills. Now, this is absolutely true, and I've seen it myself. But let's not forget that tech goes from end to end. It's not just tech people who code. There are marketing people in tech. They are HR people in tech. And these are probably one of the most versatile professions that they can actually operate in different various kind of industries. Mm. So it's really opening up the conversation around not just focusing on the fact that tech leadership needs to be the kind of people that comes from tech. If we start to accept that anybody can go into tech and anybody can achieve success in tech, then I think we're at least one step closer to it.
Yeah.
And this is exceptionally important when it comes to a remote working culture. It's because we're finally in a place to really not think about what backgrounds people come from. Mm. If you think about, let's put like a quick example. We talk about having remote working right now, and we talk about using remote as a reason to expand diversity and really put effort into this, is because we can now hire people from all over the world. But if you just look at London itself, how many people can actually afford to live and work in London? It's just a city. We're talking about one small city, right? And because of remote working, we're now able to just open up the market and hire people from all around the UK that probably didn't have the opportunity in the past to go to XYZ school that gets them noticed to go into a big bank, for example. We're now again one step closer to diversity. And I think remote working has a lot of benefits that we are still just scratching the surface at the moment, because we're still thinking, oh, it's a waste of working. People get more work-life balance. They spend more time at home with their kids, with their family. People generally are happier in terms of their well-being. But essentially, it's also an economic benefit.
I love what you've said there, Sophie. There's a couple of things. So one of the stats that we're proud of, but we know that we've got more work to do, is that over 150 hires that we've been involved in leadership roles, 43% of them are female. Now, if we could just, kind of get more CTO positions to be female, I'm sure we'd have a 50-50 split. But what we've seen happen more recently, touching on your point of you don't have to be a tech person to lead tech, is we've seen roles like the chief product officer sit above tech. And that's where we've been able to get more females into and more diversity into those types of positions. So I think that's a really valid point that you make. The other point that I want to bring up, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, Sophie, because when I looked at your profile, I have to say there's a big smile on my face, because I've been saying to our clients for the last 5-6 years, treat your employee experience strategy and approach should be exactly like your customer acquisition approach.
Yeah, good catch on that. The one reason I actually came into HR isn't just because I feel like I'm a people person, which is, I believe it's what you normally hear. You're a people person. Yeah, therefore,
it's one of the worst reasons to get into it.
Yeah, I think traditionally that's a very, very good, valid reason. But I think nowadays you can look at HR from a very different perspective. I look at HR as a product itself, and who do I serve? My employees are essentially my customers. And so I think in a lot of ways, being in tech actually allows me, first and foremost, allows me to experiment this concept and actually really apply product methodologies into HR. On the other hand, employee experience is everything. Now, we talk about our companies are only as good as our people. Now, if I'm being perfectly honest with you, I've only really learned this in the last couple of years. The reason why I also have such a huge emphasis and I really look up to social enterprises is because their customers are usually either underprivileged or which in a lot of ways led their leadership to lead their business in a very mission-driven way. Yeah. Now, because of that, it's a lot more attractive. And so therefore, they tick a lot of boxes when it comes to equality, diversity, inclusion, and all of that good stuff. But on one hand, what is really important for me when I look up to these companies are they treat their people equally just as important as their customers, because they don't tend to choose because there is a lot of competition out there. And I think more and more companies, even given or granted huge funding, should really emphasize on treating their employees just as well as their customers, because this is the only way we're ever going to actually build products that work for our customers. Exactly like what you say, we aren't going to choose our customers, so why would we choose our employees? Yeah. It's such a contradictory way of looking at it, but I think this comes from a long traditional way of looking at privilege. If you square that away and think about a business or a startup who has tons of funding, then they can kind of get away with murder.
Yeah.
It's because they feel they can.
Yeah.
But if they use those funding and actually do right by them, I can almost guarantee you they are going to be 10 times more successful than they are. It's because the challenges that they will go through during their growth phases will probably not exist.
Yeah.
And so therefore, they're talking about having highly efficient teams. They're optimizing what they're doing on a daily basis just for the right reasons.
Yeah. And look, I love what you've said there, because if you look at fintech, I mean, how many businesses have we got out there saying we're democratizing, we're banking the unbanked, we're helping people. And they don't treat their people with that narrative as well. So I think, authenticity has to stem from what the mission of the business and your customer. And as you rightly pointed out, your people are your brand to your customer, not what you've paid a designer or a marketing agency to try and put out there on socials.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, I've really only learned this the last couple of years. It's because I start to see more and more successful business that are basically focused on their culture, and culture is everything.
Yeah. Now, Emma, which company do you think is really leading the way when it comes to diversity and driving performance and results for the business as well?
That's a really hard one, actually, because there aren't necessarily that many that to pick from, I think, who are doing it really, really well. Mm. But I think, for what's in my line of sight, it would be Canva. So Canva are, obviously, we're working with them. They've been on our program 5050, they're in their second year on it now and starting to see some quite significant benefits and results starting to come through. And that's because they're tackling the systemic and structural issues rather than just the branding side of things, yeah. Which is the tendency. I think we automatically sort of focus on hiring and attraction when actually this stemming the flow of women in tech who leave their careers is absolutely got to be a focus. We need more women in leadership, and that's got to be focused on by removing the barriers for them that sit in their careers once they get to that, or in the lead up to getting to that midpoint. So I'd say them probably first and foremost. The speed of growth that Canva have been experiencing in the last few years has been incredible. And the fact that their diversity numbers haven't gone backwards, they've pretty much stayed the same, is a testament to that. Knowing that, we can't hire from overseas right now, right? So our hands are pretty tied.
Well, we could if we did it remotely. Interesting thing, yeah.
And they are doing that. So, they've started to set up teams all over the place now, and they've started to hire remotely as a result of COVID-19. But the focus for them is very much on improving the representation of women at every level. So what I see a lot of companies do is focus on the numbers in terms of representation and quoting numbers across an entire organization, where in reality, numbers in technology will be vastly skewed down. So
bit like our stats.
Yeah, exactly. So if we've got 50-50 in our company, the chances are most of them are in people and culture marketing. And the technology team will drag the average down quite dramatically. I mean, actually, Dexter, interestingly, it'd be interesting to actually look at how many you've had on your thinking about fintech, how many men and women you're interviewing as part of your podcast.
Look, I mean, it's a really good point, and it's another conversation. And we had a pretty good kind of run rate early on,
which and now it's dipped.
Almost
82% men now. Since July last year, only 18% of your interviewees are women and 82% are men. So that's not a great number, but it's just kind of, I suppose, to some degree reflective of the effort that it would take to change that up.
And we've been really, conscious of that. And any suggestions that you've got, anybody that's doing good
stuff, you want to get the story. I'll help wherever I can, for sure. Nope.
Awesome. Now, Sophie, from your side, are there any examples that you've got that really stand out as to who's doing this well?
Can I just be honest and say I think fintech is still kind of struggling, but I definitely have.
Thank you for saying that. No, thank you, because
I'm sure
there is a tendency to kind of celebrate and pat ourselves on the back when there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah, definitely. It's not great. I mean, in the UK, in the last diversity report that came out, I think there are only like 15% of women are in tech, and we're talking about maybe just 4% of them are from the BAME background. So to be honest, I think fintech needs to get over their own high horse and actually do better in that. But in a lot of ways, when it comes to the larger corporations, I think they're doing a lot better. You are starting to see a lot more, finance consulting firms. They have a lot of effort. They definitely put it on top of their agenda. At the very least, they hire a chief diversity officer. I know there's definitely controversy around talking about this role, whether or not it's actually a real role. I do think that that actually leads the way. That's the path at the very least, because if we don't talk about it and we don't acknowledge that we need to put a seat at the table, then when are we ever going to? So I do think in a lot of ways that's very positive. On the other hand, there are definitely some good startups that I look up to, like there is Fairwill in the UK. I think mental health startups as well, they're doing really well. Again, because they're such mission-based startups, it becomes easier for them to achieve diversity. It's, again, you know, diversity isn't just about having more women in tech or having more women in the company. It's having people with different kind of backgrounds, you know, and we often forget, because I think it's easier to make it binary. It's 1-0, right? It's women and male. And so, you know, if we kind of feel that that's our ultimate end goal, then I think it's a long way out.
And you know, we're talking about, you know, we're not just talking about gender or race. I mean, there's people, you know, that have you know, who aren't as able bodied as others, who have been, you know, had that massive challenge of getting into a workplace, who now you don't have that anymore, and yet we're still not seeing that number change as well, even though we've got remote working.
But don't forget, though, I think one of the things to be clear on here is that cultural diversity is an example. We are in Australia, we're pretty lucky. You know, we have great cultural diversity in technology, not so much elsewhere in the world, but certainly here we do. But women make up 51% of the population. So having 15% or less in your, who are building the products and services of the future in terms of the technology that the world is powered on, it is not okay. That's probably the biggest gap in tech. Certainly here, the biggest gap in tech is gender. So we I think the LGBT is something like 3% in terms of the population. And I think First Nations people, 3.4%. So if you've got 1 or 2% in that area, in either of those areas, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, so, but focusing on the fact that we have 51% of the population are noticeably absent, has to be a priority in my opinion. And I think, you know, generally this is why we, you know, it's so important for us to recognize that having a mixture of men and women on leadership teams, which is currently not the case, but having that mixture is so much more important. You know, a couple of years ago, David Solomon, of the CEO of Goldman Sachs, stood up and said, we're not going to IPO any more companies that don't have at least one woman on the board, and that number is going to grow. And that's testament to the fact that he was so frustrated with the state of play of you know, this massive blind spot that was just, he was seeing time and time again, that the simple fact was that companies with more diversity at that leadership level are more profitable, they're more successful. Without a shadow of a doubt, the data is all there, it's a fact. And the fact that with every 10% uplift in leadership of an organization comes a 3.5% improvement in EBIT. That's, again, a very powerful number when you start to think about how you're growing your business and what, you know, what you want your results to look like in the future.
Yeah. So, Sophie, what would be your final tips for anybody out there who's scaling or starting up a business? What should be the kind of the number one thing that they should focus on as they grow?
I have two messages. One to the people who's actually running the business, which is to ensure that you're cultivating an inclusive culture, so that, you know, you create that safe space, you create that incredible environment for everybody to be successful, not just thrive just because you're different. I think that's the most important thing. And to leadership, it's really about, if you're not in that mindset now, definitely start making changes and making steps forward to get yourself into the right mindset. Because in a lot of ways, the leadership, this is basically a top-down approach. Just like what Emma was saying, you have more diverse leadership teams, you're naturally and organically going to be able to grow an employee base that are more diverse, because people would tend to understand that, hey, just because I'm different doesn't mean I'm not feeling comfortable in the environment that I'm in. And so therefore, I'm able to open up my mind and hire different kind of people. And I think it does start from the top. So those are my two like main things that I would make sure companies actually understand. And these are, by looking at huge, big steps and first steps, it's the first step that we should be taking.
Fantastic. Now, Emma, I'm not going to ask you for a tip because Project F is more than a tip. It's a whole framework of how founders can be doing this. So do you want to tell our listeners a little bit more about Project F and the framework and the support tools that you've developed to help tech startups?
Sure. So we developed, we normally work with companies that are, I suppose the full program tends to be companies that are over 100. But for startups, we've created a couple of toolkits to help them, start with the right framework, from the very, very beginning. And what that is essentially what you need at the start of your company that will help you. And these would still be my tips. So even if you don't, you can contact me or us to get this toolkit. But essentially, I would say, thrash out a couple of things, your EVP, think about and write it down and, create it, write it down, even if it is in draft format. So what do you want people to come and work for you for? Understand what they will get for working for you other than being paid at the end of every month. So really think about what you want that to be and what it is and how you can support that, because that will help you to shape how you hire people, and especially if you can start thinking about values. The second thing is to start drafting a diversity and inclusion policy. So, I think it's one of these things that tends to just get forgotten, and a lot of even bigger companies don't have it. But when you start to write a policy, it can be brief, tech talk, not like old school sort of human resources contracts that full of Latin terms. I'm talking about something that is, this is our policy, this is our philosophy and our policy based on that. It will help you to embed the mindset that Sophie was talking about. And we actually provide you with some of these baseline policies as part of the toolkit. So you don't have to do the work. You can just tweak it to, sound like your business and put your logo on. And we also help you with the EVP part as well. So that all of these things are in the toolkit. There's a hiring kit and a whole bunch of other
fantastic,
easy to use.
And you're giving all
resources.
This stuff away for free.
Not anymore, we're not. But I will do certainly for the, if people contact me about this and quote this podcast, then yes, we will give it to them for
awesome.
Free.
That's very generous of you, Emma. Thank you for that.
That's all right.
I think a lot of, wanting to chime in. I think a lot of HR teams would be thankful for that, because I do realize that one of the most important thing, one of the most difficult thing actually as a HR person, especially in a startup or in tech, is they know that this is the right thing, but it becomes becomes exceptionally difficult to champion it. It's because it's quite hard to get the message across.
Yeah.
And not everybody has been working or have experience in building these kind of frameworks. So actually, in a lot of ways, if more HR peeps understood the importance and how to actually execute them, and I think if we see a group of success within, in short periods of time, I think more and more leaderships, especially co-founders, will start to really understand that as they're having their conversations and having their interviews or hiring their next HR person, they know this should be part of the criteria in hiring.
Yeah.
Then hopefully in that way, we're building that pathway again for a lot of the companies to understand now this is now benchmark.
Yeah. And if 100%. You consider, we've got three people on this podcast who've been doing this for a long time with very specific and relevant experience to this space. And yet we're all, absolutely aligned as to this is what you have to fix.
Yeah.
If you want to be successful, right?
Totally.
We've not talked about what job sites to use, all of that stuff. It's about this is what you got to fix and focus on first before you do anything.
Totally.
And I think that's the message that, I hope everybody takes that listens to this.
Yeah. There really is, you know, almost like a recipe list of things that have to be tackled before you've almost earned the right to go out and hire people in a way, you know?
Yeah. I couldn't agree more, Emma. I think that's a really, really valid point. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me both. Sophie, where can people find more about Oakham if they're interested in joining?
Yeah, they can definitely reach out to me directly on my LinkedIn. You can check me out on Twitter as well. Then if not, we can go straight into the Oakham website as well. We do a lot of interesting work right now, and we're always hiring. So more than happy to have any conversations at all. Anybody who wants to learn a bit more, and or if not are currently maybe struggling in HR and startup, I also have a mentoring service where I do on a weekly basis. So definitely reach out to me and hopefully I can help.
Fantastic. And Emma, where can people find out more about Project F?
So look me up on LinkedIn and you can send me a connection request, but also have a look at the website, which is projectf.com.au.
And you can find me, Dexter Cousins, on LinkedIn and Twitter. If you'd like early access to new episodes, subscribe to our newsletter by visiting the FinTech Chatter page on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider leaving us a review so we can bring you more great guests. It really helps other FinTech fans like you discover the show. FinTech Chatter is presented by Tier 1 People, leaders in FinTech executive search. We'll help you launch, scale, and innovate by delivering world-class talent. And you can find out more at tier1people.com. Until the next episode, stay safe.